Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It is useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Right up front, I'd like to give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this series of programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles published. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt, and for you to look at her website by the same name. You can also look at all the related shows in this series in the archives at www.krufm.com under Life and Debt Web, specifically related to the Web of Debt. For the last several months, we have been investigating the Web of Debt as a textbook for understanding the truth about our money system and ultimately how we can break free from the problems that it causes. As a very generic overview, I always say how our money system is not what we had been led to believe. In fact, the creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. What we're trying to do is unravel the deception and present a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. However, on a positive, optimistic note, we explore a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. Ultimately, we're trying to create financial security for ourselves and for our nation. Individual help and collective help is the goal. Now, just to review where we ended last week, we're talking about the original American government and how Hamilton got a charter for a bank. Hamilton had argued that to promote the general welfare, the country needed a monetary system that was independent of foreign masters, and for that, it needed its own federal central bank. Sounded like a good idea. The bank would handle the government's enormous war debt and create a standard form of currency. This is just right after the Revolution. Thomas Jefferson, however, was in this instance, as in most instances, enormously suspicious of Hamilton and his schemes, but Jefferson also felt strongly that the new country's capital city should be in the South, in his home state of Virginia. Hamilton actually did not care where the capital was, and he agreed on the location of the national capital in exchange for Jefferson's agreement on the bank. When Hamilton called for a tax on whiskey to pay the interest on the government's securities, however, it was felt that he went too far. Jefferson's supporters were furious. In the type of political compromise still popular today, President George Washington proposed moving the capital even closer to Mount Vernon. In 1789, Congress passed Hamilton's bill, but the president still had to sign it. Washington was concerned about the continued opposition of Jefferson and the Virginians, who thought the bill was unconstitutional. The public would have to use the bank, but the bank would not have to serve the public. Hamilton assured the president that, to protect the public, the bank would be required to retain a percentage of gold in reserve so that it could redeem its paper notes in gold or silver on demand. Hamilton was a very eloquent speaker, and in 1791, Washington signed the bill into law. Originally, the new banking scheme was hailed as a brilliant solution to the nation's economic straits, one that disposed of an oppressive national debt, stabilized the economy, funded the government's budget, and created confidence in new paper dollars. At that time, if the new Congress had simply printed its own paper money, speculators would have challenged the currency's worth and driven down its value, just as they had done during the Revolution. To maintain public confidence in the national currency and establish its stability, the new republic needed the illusion that its dollars were backed by the banker's gold, and Hamilton's bank successfully met that challenge. The psychology here is the most important thing, the political psychology. It did get the country up and running, but it left the bank largely in private hands, where it could still be manipulated for private greed. Worse, the government ended up in debt for money it could have generated itself, indeed should have generated itself under the U.S. Constitution. So this is the birth of the banking system influence on the U.S. government. The U.S. government is borrowing from private banks, not making its own money, that is printing it and putting it out for people to use to represent the product and services that people provide. And the challenging blow is that the government was having to pay interest on the money it was borrowing. Now, this is such a deep fundamental mistake, which is still currently driving our system into the brink or the abyss we were talking about just a moment ago. And it's at a foundational level that most of us do not even consider. We take it for granted. And once those premises are set, then all of the challenges that we experience follow quite naturally and are mostly irreversible. Well, at the beginning of our country, the charter for the new bank fixed its total initial capitalization at $10 million. $8 million were to come from private stockholders and $2 million from the government. But once again, the government did not actually have $2 million. It wasn't creating its own money, and it didn't have the gold or silver. So the bank, now a chartered lending institution, lent the government the money at interest. Now, the biggest deception here is that the bank, of course, did not have any money either. The whole thing was a sleight of hand. The rest of the bank shares were sold to the public, who bought some in hard cash and some in government securities, which are the IOUs that had been issued by the revolutionary government and the states. The U.S. government had to pay 6% interest annually on all the securities now held by the bank, those exchanged for the loan of the government's own money, plus the bonds accepted by the bank from the public. The bank's shareholders were supposed to pay 1/4 the cost of their shares in gold, but only the first installment was actually paid in hard money, totaling $675,000. The rest was paid in paper banknotes. Some came from the Bank of Boston and the Bank of New York, but most of this paper money was issued by the new U.S. bank itself and lent back to its new shareholders through the magic of fractional reserve lending. Remember, fractional reserve lending means that the bank could lend many, many times the amount of money that it supposedly held in reserve, theoretically in specie of gold or silver, which in essence is creating money out of nothing. They were lending money they did not have. Well, within 5 years, the new government had borrowed $8.2 million from the bank. The additional money was obviously created out of thin air, just as it would have been if the government itself had printed the money. So this was a major misstep by the inaugural government of the United States. Unfortunately, instead, the government now owed principal and interest back to the private bank. To reduce its debt to the bank, the government was eventually forced to sell its shares, and here we go again, back to the British financiers. At this point, we've gone a full circle, and even Hamilton, to his credit, opposed those sales. But the sales went through, and the First Bank of the United States wound up largely under foreign ownership and control. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to Hamilton. Hamilton was widely acclaimed as a brilliant writer, orator, and thinker. But to Thomas Jefferson, he remained a diabolical schemer, a British stooge pursuing a political agenda for his own ends. The First Bank of the United States was modeled on the Bank of England, the same private bank against which the colonists had just rebelled. Years later, Jefferson would say that Hamilton had tricked him into approving the bank's charter. Jefferson had always suspected Hamilton of monarchical sympathies, and all his schemes seemed tainted with corruption. Jefferson would go so far as to tell Washington he thought Hamilton was a dangerous traitor. He also complained to Madison about Hamilton's bookkeeping. He said, "I do not wonder at all at the condition in which the finances of the United States are found. Hamilton's object from the beginning was to throw them into forms which should be utterly indecipherable." On the other side, Hamilton, for his part, thought little better of Jefferson. And maybe we are all at a loss because of this. It turned out that the feud between these two founding fathers resulted in the two-party system. Hamilton's party was the Federalist. They favored a strong central government funded by a centralized federal banking system. Jefferson's party, the Democratic Republicans, or simply Republicans, favored state and individual rights. Jefferson's party was responsible for passing the Bill of Rights. Hamilton had worked with Aaron Burr in New York City to establish the Manhattan Bank, which would eventually become what we know to be the Chase Manhattan Bank. But Hamilton broke with Burr and the Boston Federalists when he learned that they were plotting to split the northern states from the Union. Hamilton's first loyalty was to the Republic. Burr and his faction were working closely with British allies, who would later try to break up the Union by backing the Confederacy in the Civil War. Hamilton swung his support to Jefferson against Burr in the presidential election of 1800, and other patriotic Federalists did the same. The Federalist Party ceased to be a major national party after the War of 1812, when the Boston Federalists sided with England, which lost. In 1801, Jefferson became the president with Hamilton's support, while Burr became vice president. In 1804, when Burr sought the governorship of New York, he was again defeated largely through Hamilton's opposition. In the course of the campaign, Hamilton accused Burr in a newspaper article of being a dangerous man who ought not to be trusted with the reins of government. When Hamilton refused to apologize, Burr challenged him to a duel, and at the age of 49, Hamilton was dead. He still remains a controversial figure, but Hamilton earned his place in history. He succeeded in stabilizing the shaky new economy and getting the country on its feet, and his notions of monetizing debt and federalizing the banking system were major innovations. He restored the country's credit, gave it a national currency, made it economically independent, and incorporated strong federal provisions into the Constitution that would protect and nurture the young country according to a uniquely American system founded on promoting the general welfare. Those are a lot of positive contributions. But Hamilton also left a darker legacy that still we face today. Lurking behind the curtain in his new national bank A privileged class of financial middlemen was now legally entitled to siphon off a perpetual tribute in the form of interest. And because they controlled the money spigots, they could fund their own affiliated businesses with easy credit, squeezing out competitors and perpetuating the same class divisions that the American system was supposed to have circumvented. The money power had been delivered into private hands, and they were largely foreign hands. The same interests that had sought to keep America in a colonial state, subservient to an elite class of oligarchical financiers. Who were these foreign financiers, and how had they acquired so much leverage? Well, we're back to the Wizard of Oz. The Yellow Brick Road takes us farther back in history, back to when the concept of usury was first devised. Now we move ahead from the matriarchies of abundance to the patriarchies of debt. Remember what the Wicked Witch of the West said to Dorothy when Dorothy threw the bucket of water on her? She said, "I'm melting. My world, who would have thought a little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness?" So back to the wonderful Wizard of Oz. When Frank Baum made his witch-vanquishing hero a defenseless young girl, he probably wasn't thinking about the gender ramifications of economic systems. But Bernard Leiter has given this subject some serious thought. In his book, The Mystery of Money, he traces the development of two competing monetary schemes, one based on shared abundance, the other based on scarcity, greed, and debt. The former characterized the matriarchal societies of antiquity. The latter characterized the warlike patriarchal societies that forcibly displaced them. The issue wasn't really of gender, of course, since every society is composed half of each. The struggle was between two archetypal worldviews. What Leiter called the matriarchal and patriarchal systems, Henry Clay called the American and British systems, cooperative abundance versus competitive greed. But that classification isn't really accurate either, or fair to the British people, since their own economic conquerors also came from somewhere else, and the British succeeded in withstanding the moneylenders' advances for hundreds of years. The American system devised in the American colonies was actually foreshadowed in the tally system of medieval England. And Leiter traces this archetypal struggle back much farther than 17th century England. He traces it to the cradle of Western civilization in ancient Sumer. Now, this is located where Iraq is today, but Sumer was a matriarchal agrarian economy with a financial system based on abundance and shared wealth. One of the oldest known bronze coins was Sumerian shekel, dating from 3200 BC. It was inscribed with the likeness of the goddess Inanna-Ishtar, who bestowed kingship in Sumer and was the goddess of fertility, life, and death. Inanna wore the horns of a cow, the sacred animal that personified the Great Mother everywhere in ancient myth. Hathor, the Egyptian equivalent, had cow ears and a human face and was the goddess of love, fertility, and abundance. Her horn was a cornucopia from which poured the earth's plenty. Isis, an even more powerful Egyptian mother figure, was portrayed wearing the horns of a cow with the sun disk between them. In India, the cow goddess was Kali, for whom cows are sacred even to this day. Cows were also associated with money, since they were an early medium of exchange. The Sumerian word for interest was the same as the word for calf. It was natural to repay advances of cattle with an extra calf, because the unit of exchange itself multiplied over the loan period. This was also true for grain, for which the temples served as storehouses. Grain advanced over the growing period was repaid with extra grain after the harvest, in gratitude to God for multiplying the community's abundance. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond.
The temples were public institutions that also served welfare-type functions, including the support of widows, orphans, the elderly, and the infirm. Temples were endowed with land to provide food for their dependent labor, and resources such as herds of sheep to provide wool for their workshops. They operated autonomously, supporting themselves not through taxation, but by renting lands and workshops and charging interest on loans. Goods were advanced to traders who returned the value of the goods plus interest. The temples also acted as central banks. Sacrificial coins inscribed debt to the gods were paid to the farmers in acknowledgement that wheat had been contributed to the temple. These coins were also lent to the borrowers. When interest was paid on the loans, it went back to the temple to fund the community's economic and social programs and to cover losses from bad loans. It was only after the Indo-European invasions of the second millennium BC that money lending became the private enterprise of infamous money changers. The goddess Inanna was superseded as the source of supreme kingship by the male god Enlil of Nippur, and the matriarchal system of shared communal abundance was forcibly displaced by a militant patriarchal system. The cornucopia of the horned goddess became the bullhorns of the thunder god, representing masculine power, virility, and force. In the temple system, the community extended the credit and received the money back with interest. In the system that displaced it, interest on debts went into private vaults to build the private fortunes of the money changers. Interest was thus transformed from a source of income for the community into a tool for impoverishing and enslaving people and nations. Unlike corn and cows, the gold the moneylenders lent was inorganic. It did not grow, so there was never enough to cover the additional interest charges added to loans. When there was insufficient money in circulation to cover operating expenses, farmers had to borrow until harvest time, and the odd man out in the musical chairs of finding 11 coins to repay 10 wound up in debtor's prison. Historically, most slavery originated from debt. Usury is now defined as charging excess interest, but originally it meant merely charging a fee or interest for the use of money. Usury was forbidden in the Christian Bible, and anti-usury laws were strictly enforced by the Catholic Church until the end of the Middle Ages. But in Jewish scriptures, which were later joined to the Christian books as the Old Testament, usury was forbidden only between brothers. Charging interest to foreigners was allowed and even encouraged. The money changers thus came to be associated with the Jews, but they were not actually the Jewish people. In fact, the Jewish people may have suffered more than any other people from the money changers' schemes, which were responsible for much antisemitism. In the informative documentary video, The Money Masters, Bill Still and Patrick Carmack point out that when Jesus threw the money changers out of the temple, it was actually to protect the Jewish people. Half shekels, the only pure silver coins of assured weight, without the image of a pagan emperor on them, were the only coins considered acceptable for paying the temple tax, a tribute to God. But half shekels were scarce, and the money changers had cornered the market for them. Like the modern banking cartel, they had monopolized the medium of exchange and were exacting a charge for its use. Despite the injunctions in the New Testament, there were times when the king needed money. In the Middle Ages, England was short of gold, which had left during the Crusades. In 1087, when King William Rufus needed gold to do business with the French, he therefore admitted the moneylenders on condition that the interest be demanded in gold and that half be paid to the king. But the moneylenders eventually became so wealthy at the expense of the people that the church, with urgings from the Pope, prohibited them from taking interest. And in 1290, when they had lost their usefulness to the king, most Jews were again expelled from the country. This pattern in which Jews as people have been persecuted for the profiteering of a few and have been used as scapegoats to divert attention from the activities of the rulers has been repeated over the centuries. Meanwhile, England was faced with the problem of what to use for money when the country was short of gold. The coinage system was commodity-based. It assumed that money was something having value in itself, gold or silver, which was bartered or traded for goods or services of equal value. But according to Stephen Zerlenga, who has traced the origins and history of money in his revealing compendium, The Lost Science of Money, the use of coins as money did not originate with merchants trading in the marketplace. The first known coins were issued by governments, and their value was the value stamped on them, not the price at which the metal traded. Zerlenga quotes Aristotle, who said, "Money exists not by nature, but by law. It acts as a measure that makes goods commensurate and equates them. There must then be a unit, and that fixed by the government." Money was a mere fiat of the law. Fiat means "let it be done" in Latin. Fiat money is money that is legal tender by government decree. It is simply a tally, something representing units of value that can be traded in the market, a receipt for goods or services that can legally be tendered for other goods or services. In Mandarin China, where paper money was invented in the 9th century, this sort of fiat currency funded a long and prosperous empire. Fiat money was also used successfully in medieval England, but in England, it was made of wood. The English tally system originated with King Henry I, son of William the Conqueror, who took the throne in 1100 AD. The printing press had not yet been invented, and taxes were paid directly with goods produced by the land. Under King Henry's innovative system, payment was recorded with a piece of wood that had been notched and split in half. One half was kept by the government and the other by the recipient. To confirm payment, the two halves were matched to make sure they tallied. Since no stick splits in an even manner, and since the notches tallying the sums were cut right through both pieces of wood, the method was virtually foolproof against forgery. The tally system has been called the earliest form of bookkeeping. According to historian M.T. Clanchy, he said, "Tallies were a sophisticated and practical record of numbers. They were more convenient to keep and store than parchments, less complex to make, and no easier to forge." Only a few hundred tallies survive, Clanchy writes, but millions were made. Tallies were used by the government not only as receipts for the payment of taxes, but to pay soldiers for their services, farmers for their wheat, and laborers for their labor. By the 13th century, the financial market for tallies was sufficiently sophisticated that they could be bought, sold, or discounted. Tallies were used by individuals and institutions to register debts, record fines, collect rents, and enter payments for services rendered. In the 1500s, King Henry VIII gave them the force of a national currency when he ordered that tallies must be used to evidence the payment of taxes. That meant everyone had to have them. In War Cycles, Peace Cycles, Richard Hoskins writes that by the end of the 17th century, about 14 million pounds worth of tally money was in circulation. Zerlenga cites a historian named Spufford who said that English coinage had never exceeded 500,000 pounds up to that time. The tally system was thus not a minor monetary experiment, as some commentators have suggested. During most of the Middle Ages, tallies may have made up the bulk of the English money supply. The tally system was in use for more than 5 centuries before the usury bankers' gold-based paper banknotes took root. And I will continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipitak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.